This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Monday, May 6th. I'm John Wanamaker. With just 2 weeks left in the legislative session, conference committee negotiations will heat up on several key budget bills, but most of the big differences between those House and Senate bills won't be resolved until DFL leaders can strike a deal with Governor Mark Dayton on a big-picture tax and spending plan. Another minimum wage vote is expected this week, and lawmakers could finally be ready to take up the bill to legalize same-sex marriage. Capitol reporter Tim Pugmire sat down with Morning Edition host Kathy Werzer to talk about the week ahead.
Let's start with that same-sex marriage bill. What are the House and Senate leaders saying about their plans for four votes?
Well, they still aren't making any firm commitments about the vote, but a somewhat surprising development over the weekend, House Democrats announced that the bill is going to get another committee hearing, which is scheduled later today. The House Ways and Means Committee is going to take a look at the marriage bill and a just-completed fiscal note that shows the predicted financial impact of the bill, the costs associated mainly with state employee spouse benefits, but also some new revenue from an increase in marriage license fees. So you recall, it's been quite a while. Back in mid-March, the only time there was a House hearing on this bill, it was in the Civil Law Committee, passed on a party-line vote, 10-7. So it looks like we're going to get another vote later today. Still not the floor vote, however. An advisory from the House DFL caucus on the hearing said a decision had not been made yet. Speaker Paul Thiessen said Friday he's still talking to DFL members about it. Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach said he's not sure about the timing of the vote, but he said there's a chance the Senate will take action on it before the House does.
Now, isn't it a change that Senator Bach was saying that the Senate could take it up possibly first? Wasn't he the one who said, look, we want to get all the tax and spending bills out of the way and then take up same-sex marriage?
Right, and they are sticking to that. I think specifically what he said is he wanted those bills in conference committee, and that's where they're at. But he did make it clear all session he wanted the House to go first because the outcome there was less certain than in the Senate. Box convinced the Senate has the votes to pass the bill, but he doesn't want to take that vote if he doesn't have to. Box said House leaders are the ones that expressed some interest in the Senate going first, so he speculated that they must think they have the votes now. He said he's going to talk about this issue privately later today with Speaker Thiessen.
You mentioned conference committees. Let's talk about that. Several are meeting. They began last week. They're going to continue to meet this week. Are they making progress?
Well, a limited amount. They've been going through side-by-side comparisons on these bills, working on the similarities and the policy provisions, but the real financial work hinges on these broader negotiations. They need to get the overall spending numbers figured out before they can plow ahead. Senator Bach said he hopes some of those numbers are in place early this week. Surprisingly, there have been no meetings yet of the K-12 Education Committee, and DFL Representative Paul Marquardt said he doesn't plan to call one until he knows exactly what dollar figure he's working with.
Those dollar figures are, of course, the targets. So where do things stand with the end-of-session negotiations on those targets between the governor and leaders in the House and Senate?
Well, Governor Dayton was out of town for a few days, so there weren't any meetings over the weekend, but he does have private meetings scheduled today with some of his key commissioners as well as the DFL House and Senate leaders. In addition to the spending levels on the budget bills, they need to negotiate a revenue number, how much they want to raise out of the tax bill. And, of course, that's where some of the biggest differences are, both in how much revenue and how it gets raised.
The House passed the minimum wage bill Friday. Will the Senate vote on it this week?
It's tentatively scheduled for Wednesday. Senate Democrats rolled out their minimum wage bill increase as one of a priority bill at the beginning of session, but the Senate bill increases the minimum wage to $7.75 an hour by 2015, and that's significantly less than the House increase that passed Friday that would increase it to $9.50 an hour. Both bills include automatic future increases based on inflation, but there are a few other differences, and so once again, we're going to see another conference committee, presuming that bill passes in the Senate this week, to iron out the differences.
That's Morning Edition host Kathy Werzer talking with Capitol reporter Tim Pugmire. Hennepin County Commissioner Jeff Johnson is the latest Republican to enter the race for governor. Johnson kicked off his campaign in the western suburbs yesterday, and as Tom Scheck reports, he's hoping to stitch together a coalition of Republicans who have been at odds with each other in the last few election cycles.
Jeff Johnson made his announcement to a room full of supporters at the community center in Hamel. Like most Republicans looking at the race for governor in 2014, Johnson said he was worried about the direction of the state under DFL Governor Mark Dayton and the DFL-controlled legislature. He said he doesn't believe most Minnesotans agree with their plan to raise taxes.
And it is a state where the big debate in St. Paul isn't about whether to increase taxes on clothing versus haircuts versus, God forbid, beer, but how we unleash that creative, innovative power of every individual Minnesotan to grow our economy and to make us all just a little bit more prosperous.
Johnson said he's focusing his campaign on three issues: jobs, education, and improving government services. He focused his talking points on creating a low-tax environment to bolster economic development in the state and on tackling Minnesota's achievement gap in education. He told reporters after his speech that he's unlikely to support any tax increases if he's governor.
When someone can show me that government is spending the money it already has responsibly and efficiently and without wasting anything and on programs that actually produce results, and that we really have cut the fat out of government, then come and talk to me about a tax hike. But we are, in my opinion, so far from that right now, it makes my head spin.
Johnson said he's not going to sign a no new taxes pledge, though, because he worries it will be a distraction. He is pledging, however, to abide by the party endorsement. Johnson said he will not run in a primary if he doesn't win the backing of GOP delegates. But he thinks he's best suited to win the race for governor because he has the resume to win over conservative GOP delegates without alienating independent voters.
We can't win a statewide race with only Republican votes. The numbers just aren't there in Minnesota. But what we also have to recognize is that we can't win a statewide race without a very excited and energized Republican base. We've got to have them both in the race for governor to win.
This isn't Johnson's first attempt at statewide office. He lost his bid for attorney general in 2006 to Democrat Lori Swanson. Johnson is the second major Republican to announce he's running for governor. Orono businessman Scott Honor announced his candidacy last month. There are several more who are also considering a run. They include State Representative Kurt Zellers, State Senators Dave Thompson, Julie Rosen, and David Hahn, and Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek. Zellers, who served as Speaker of the Minnesota House, says he won't make a decision until the legislative session is over. He said, however, that he knows the state well because he served as Speaker and also worked for former U.S. Senator Rod Grams.
I spent the better part of 20 years since 1994 traveling the state of Minnesota. I know the different aspects of it. I know the different qualities, the great things about, you know, the Iron Range that's different from Worthington or the Mayo Clinic versus Marvin Windows. And when you look at all those things and take them in perspective, I think understanding them individually, but then how they fit together as a collective for our state.
Governor Dayton has repeatedly said he's running for a second term, but is opting not to comment on any potential challengers until Republicans settle on one candidate. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Efforts to boost Minnesota's anti-bullying law are up for discussion at the Capitol this week. Tim Post has more.
The Safe and Supportive Schools Bill is scheduled to be debated on the House floor. The bill revamps Minnesota's anti-bullying law, which at 37 words is considered one of the weakest in the nation. Advocates of the bill say it helps schools develop effective policies on how to prevent and deal with bullying. Opponents say it's too far-reaching and doesn't allow schools to tailor their own approaches to bullying prevention. The Senate version of the bill will be taken up this week in an education committee. The bill needs to then pass through the full Senate Finance Committee before it makes it to the Senate floor. How to pay for any new anti-bullying efforts is still a question. School officials say they fear the measure will become an unfunded mandate if lawmakers don't provide adequate money to implement changes in bullying policy.
That's education reporter Tim Post. Minnesota could take another step ahead in the transition to renewable energy under legislation on the floors of the House and Senate this week. The bills would increase the use of solar systems in homes and businesses. Utilities are leery of the requirements, saying they could be costly and unfair to ratepayers. Stephanie Hemphill has more.
Minnesota utilities are already replacing coal-fired power plants with windmills, prompted by the state's landmark 2007 Next Generation Energy Act. A healthy wind power industry grew up in the state partly as a result. Now, says the chair of the Senate Energy and Environment Committee, DFLer John Marty, it's time for solar.
There are lots of folks, businesses in Minnesota that are eager to get going on this, but they need a little boost right now. And the faster we make the solar industry start growing here in Minnesota, the faster the prices fall.
Marty's bill and a companion in the House both require utilities to produce gradually increasing amounts of solar power. The House bill still has the original goal of 4% solar by 2025. In the Senate, it's been whittled down to 1%. Big utilities, rural electric co-ops, and city-owned power companies say a solar mandate would be much too expensive. Joel Johnson is with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. He says the co-ops are still absorbing the costs of the 2007 renewable mandates.
Electric co-ops are very long on generation right now. And when you mandate a utility to build and increase their generation when they already have more than their customers, or in our case, our members, can use, it starts getting really expensive.
So the bill's authors exempted co-ops and municipal utilities from the requirements. Meanwhile, the state's investor-owned utilities say solar electricity is still more expensive than other forms of power, and their customers shouldn't be required to buy it. Representative Melissa Hortman, a DFLer, the author of the House bill, told the House Ways and Means Committee last week the bill tries to balance the current and future costs of solar.
Yes, it's more expensive to install this capital up front, but it does decrease costs in other ways. For one thing, we know what the price of solar energy will be 30 years from now. We don't know what the price of natural gas will be. We don't know what the price of coal will be.
And she says solar panels will help utilities by producing a lot of power on summer afternoons when people crank up their air conditioners. Xcel Energy's Rick Evans testified the bill is unfair because it requires people who don't have solar panels to subsidize people who do have them. He says a family or business that lowers its electric bill by generating some of its own electricity is still using the system's essential infrastructure.
All of the wires, all of the poles, all of the infrastructure right back to the generation source are also included in those kilowatt hour charges. And if they're not going to pay for all the kilowatt hours that they were before, then their neighbors who don't have a solar panel, who can't afford to put one up, are going to have to pick up the slack.
Evans is negotiating with the bill's authors to try to figure out a way to fix that. And there's another fairness concern. The Senate bill exempts some industries and not others. Iron mining and paper mills use a lot of electricity, and those groups argue they shouldn't have to subsidize rooftop solar installations. They successfully lobbied to be excluded, which dramatically reduces Minnesota Power's obligation to invest in solar. But other industries, such as oil refineries, also use a lot of power, and at least so far, they haven't been exempted. Senator Marty says he's frustrated with how much he's had to compromise to move his bill forward.
Whatever we do this year, no matter how bold we try to be, I think the next generation in 15 or 20 years are going to be looking back and say, you saw all the signs of what was happening. Why were you so timid?
Marty says his bill could be strengthened on the Senate floor, where it's expected to be heard early this week, or in conference committee. Stephanie Hemphill, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota Supreme Court hears oral arguments today in a case that could affect what the public can find out about how tax money is being spent. The case started when a tiny newspaper in northern Minnesota started asking questions about a major school district reconstruction project. The company overseeing the project refused to reveal one of its contracts, and now the dispute has made it all the way to the state Supreme Court. Elizabeth Dunbar reports.
The court's decision could impact every situation where a government agency hires a private company to do work. That company often hires other companies, especially for big jobs. Think about the new Minnesota Vikings Stadium in Minneapolis, or the new light rail line in the Twin Cities. The case before the Supreme Court started more than 2 years ago when the Timber Jay newspaper was reporting on a nearly $80 million reconstruction project in the St. Louis County School District. The district hired Johnson Controls to oversee the project. And Timberjay editor and publisher Marshall Helmberger cited the state's open records law in requesting more detailed information from the company.
There were a significant number of architectural problems, things that had to go back and be redone, actually, through the change order process because there were designs that were not up to state code. And unfortunately, this ended up increasing the cost of the overall project fairly substantially.
When the newspaper asked Johnson Controls to see its agreement with an architectural firm, Johnson Controls said it was private. The newspaper took the case all the way to the Minnesota Court of Appeals and won. But Johnson Controls argued the contract contained trade secrets and asked the Supreme Court to weigh in. And now, contractors, government agencies, and public records advocates are all watching the case closely. Attorney Dean Thompson has represented the Minnesota Associated General Contractors. He says it's clear that government officials have to provide certain information under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. But he says it's different when a private company holds the information.
You have a lot of proprietary data that one contractor wouldn't want its competitors to know. If contractor X has proprietary pricing in his contract, what would prevent contractor Y from filing a Data Practices Act request and saying, I want to see all the pricing that contractor X has? We'd get into all sorts of arguments about what has to be produced and what doesn't have to be produced. Currently, we don't have that.
John Borger is an attorney who has represented media organizations in data practices disputes. He acknowledged that some information could be considered private, but he says he predicts the court won't change the intent of the law.
It ought to decide the question in favor of public access, just as the legislature and other courts below the Supreme Court level have been deciding this type of issue for almost 25 years.
Even if the court sides with the Timberjay on the larger issue, the two sides could well be back in court battling over what's considered a trade secret. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Stearns County authorities have joined the search for clues to the disappearance of an Eden Prairie woman whose ex-boyfriend committed suicide outside the Eden Prairie police station. Eden Prairie police say they believe the ex-boyfriend, 24-year-old David Rowe, likely traveled in parts of Stearns County after he was last seen with 24-year-old Mandy Matula, so officials there joined in the search on Sunday. Police also say unspecified items of interest led to a search in Carver County on Sunday. Matula has been missing since leaving her family's home late Wednesday. She was last seen with Rowe, who shot himself on Thursday and died on Friday. An educator from St. Paul Public Schools is Minnesota's 2013 Teacher of the Year. Megan Hall teaches high school biology and life sciences at Open World Learning Community in downtown St. Paul. The mother of a 3-year-old, Hall uses hands-on experience like a trip to the Mississippi River to teach her students about science. Hall says the achievement gap is the biggest issue in education today.
We're a democracy. We care about having a nation of equals, and we don't have it right now. Not everybody is born with the same advantages, and I think education is the key to closing the achievement gap. I think that teachers are the agents of democracy. And the more we work together in our schools, the closer we're going to get to a true democracy.
Hall says she wants to help teachers collaborate with their colleagues and foster long-term relationships with students and their families so they'll feel more fulfilled in their jobs. In sports, the Minnesota Wild scored just over 2 minutes into overtime to beat the Chicago Blackhawks 3-2 Sunday at Xcel Energy Center. The Western Conference quarterfinal series stands at 2-1 in favor of Chicago. The two teams meet again tomorrow at the X. That's the NPR News update for Monday, May 6th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.